My Michelle Live, entertainment review. Roll out the red carpet. Here's Michelle.
I think it's a red carpet kind of a day. Funny thing, when you talk about entertainment or the characters that we see on TV and film, you realize that in the real world, all that glitters isn't always gold, so to speak. But once in a while, you hear a story that flipping lights you up. You hear a story about someone that you grew up watching and knowing, even hearing in cartoon voices. When you hear that backstory, your heart just swells and you're a little inspired. Well, today, I guarantee you're going to laugh, you're going to sigh, you're going to be inspired, or I promise your money back. If you were born before the turn of to the 21st century, then you absolutely have seen this man, Harvey Korman. Of course you have. I mean, Harvey Korman was everywhere as I was growing up. Harvey left us in 2008, but for those really close to him, like his family, and like his son, his memory lives on. And today you're going to hear a bit of the behind-the-scenes stories of one of America's funniest men like ever, but also something he loved so much more than the fame, the fortune, the lights, the camera. It's his son. And I want to introduce you to his son, Chris Korman. Chris, welcome. It's good to have you, my friend.
Oh, my dear Michelle, I've been so thrilled to be on with you. Finally, you've been going back and forth for about, what, a month now?
Yes, we have. But you know what's been wonderful about that is that I think I can call you my friend now. You are just a precious soul.
Absolutely. I feel the same way about you, Michelle.
And I'm wondering if that, too, is part of your father's legacy. We know who Harvey Korman is. Finding out a little bit more about Chris Korman, his son, you were born during the height of his fame. Harvey was in Blazing Saddles, Dracula, Dead and Loving It, you know, just some really funny movies, but also the Carol Burnett Show for ever playing many, many characters, also the spinoff Mama's Family. He's someone that we all really knew, but interestingly enough, he had a son. And Chris, even beyond just being his son, your dad invested in you in innovative ways. You were a little boy with a learning disability.
I was not supposed to live past 72 hours. I had a thing called Hyline, H-Y-L-I-E-N-E, membrane disease, which is a lack of oxygen to the brain and the central nervous system. And if you didn't clear the 72-hour window, you became a blue baby. So I grew up with a learning disability and a speech impediment, which I've had reconstructive jaw surgery at 14. I had surgery on my eyes at the age of 2. At the Jules Stein Medical Center at UCLA. I look like somewhere between Roger Rabbit and sounded like Bugs Bunny. I fit really well in the show business world because I look like a cartoon character out of Warner Brothers.
You were adorable. And even now, I look at you and I can see your dad in you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That's a compliment to me because he was a much better looking person than he actually gave himself credit for. He was a very good looking man. I don't know if he thought of himself as that way. I don't know if I do, but if my wife does, that's good enough for me.
That's good. Yeah.
I tell you, it's so funny that you mentioned about the LD issue and who he was as an advocate. He really did push the idea without me knowing it is because the clinical diagnosis of a Lynch disability is the delay or the challenge of retention of information. So he said, don't necessarily do theater because you want to be famous. Do it because it'll challenge and hone your ability to retain information. Because you get a script for a play on a Monday. By Wednesday, the blocking has changed, maybe the script has changed. So you learn how to purge your brain of information given to you on Monday. By Wednesday, it's changed. By Friday, it's changed. They said, if anything the LD is going to be challenged by theater, is that you're going to be able to realize, A, you can retain more than you think you do, because what you're doing is what you love. If you do what you love, retaining information should be easier. So also, in the art of theater, it's very inclusive-based. It's about teamwork. So you have to learn how to up your game with everybody else. And people are not going to care you have a learning disability. People are not going to care you have a speech impediment. They're not going to care who your father is. They're going to care that you can up your game with them. And this is a way of saying, I'm not going to let you use the LD as a crutch.
Yeah.
I'm not going to set the LD as a crutch.
That's beautiful, because it's a balance between accepting you for who you are, for your strengths and even your weaknesses, but also not allowing that to be a crutch to keep you back. And it was a very innovative way of thinking back in the day. I want to take just a moment for our audience sake, just give a little reminder of who your dad was.
Oh, hey, buddy, do me a favor, will you? I'm going to light on for a few minutes. Will you let me know when I'm on next?
This is from the Carol Burnett Show. I love how the audience just laughs. He's doing nothing but lying on a couch and they're laughing at him. Your dad made an investment in you. And this is amazing as you're watching, listening, or reading. Now, today, it is really chic to be the spokesperson for a disability, for a disease, for disabled children, for disadvantaged people. It's cool. It's chic. And all the celebrities are doing it, right? I mean, you think of Angelina Jolie and you're thinking of little kids saving the world. But back in the day, your dad did it before it was a thing.
Right. Well, here's the thing you said about that. He was the national spokesperson for what was to become the LDA, Learning Disabilities Association. Back in the 80s, it was called the Association of Special Ed Teachers. So he goes on the Tonight Show in 82 and tells Johnny Carson that I'm going to Chicago to speak at the National Conference of Teachers for Special Ed. I'm in the green room, and people look at me like, did you know your father's going to do that? I thought he was in the bathroom the whole time. I mean, really. He didn't talk about it. He just did it. So, Michelle, in 2017, I went to Baltimore, where I lived with my wife. At one time, I spoke at the National Conference of Special Ed Teachers, LDA. And the president of the LDA came up to me and said, you know, your father put us on the map by being our national spokesperson, by putting a face of being a parent of a child with a learning disability. And all of these people came around me and said, oh my God, your father meant so much to me. He was our faith. He was our voice. I mean, the idea of somebody to be out there who's a public figure to say, it's okay to have a child with a learning disability. And I was going to go there and talk about how important it is to create a certain niche in this world that you can call your own. Because if you think about it, we are our own business card. For our own branding company, we have to articulate our brand and get it out there. And she said, well, your speech is going to be about that. I said, yes, it's going to be about find your own place in this world. But you know, it's just my luck that my father spends a good portion of my childhood being your spokesperson. Knowing my luck, knowing who my father is, isn't it surprising that I have to follow a cross dresser?
Yeah, if you don't know what my friend here is talking about, let's just play another quick little thing here that just is a little maybe indicative of Chris's growing up and identifying with his dad. Yeah, that's Chris's dad
that
right there.
That was a good segue, Michelle. That was a great segue. I like that. You were ready for me, weren't you?
Well, you know, your father wasn't like Joe's down the street. And that's true. But yet he provided, as you point out in your book, just a really beautiful life, a lot of support. And as I want to put a picture of your book up, I would like people to just get a slice of your life by reading this book. Now, there'll be a link on My Michelle Live, but your book is written almost like the Carol Burnett Show, which was a variety show. There's vignettes in this show. They made you laugh. They made you think. That's what your book does as well. It is ideal for someone to just pick up and read a little vignette from your life and from your interaction and memories of your father.
Oh, you actually touched on something I never thought of until you just said it. It's funny, when you said vignettes, consciously or subconsciously, I told my wife, I said, that's how I want the book to come off. I want it to come off as little vignettes. But I didn't use the word vignette. And now that you said, you validated the idea. I didn't want it to be long. I didn't want it to be preachy. I didn't want to get on a soapbox. I didn't want to become maudlin about it, because that wasn't the point, because everybody does those books. I want it to be a measured version or interpretation of who my father was, because Carol had written her book. Tim has written her book. His book, Nikki wrote her book. Everybody has an interpretation of my father, their interpretation of my father, not my interpretation of my father. And my wife said, write a love letter to his fans. And that was my approach. Write a love letter to people who would not go, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And I wanted that book to have that quality. You say vignettes. I thought, my God, you're very astute, because that's how I was thinking about the format of the book. Was I wanted to do short stories so people didn't get so consumed with, oh my God, you know. And I didn't want to come off as bragging either. I wanted to come off as somebody who was celebrating his father, not saying, hey, look at me, how great my life is because of my father. It has its pros and its cons. And I wanted that to be interpreted, that I had my blessings and I've had my challenges. And no amount of wealth and fame can challenge that idea that we're all flawed. We all have shortcomings. It's what you do with them.
There's something spectacular when you realize everybody has their challenges in life. Fame can be a challenge as well. Then coming home and having to be a real dad and dealing with a son that does have a real learning disability. Do you think that grounded your dad?
Oh, I think so. I think it did. I think, you know, you see the word art is in the word cathartic. So in some strange way, my dad going to the sandbox that is the Burnett Show, but he got to purge all that angst, whatever anxieties or insecurities he did have as a father, he could put it to his performance and get it out of him. So when he could come home, my mother had his attention as a man and as a father, not as a performer. So the Burnett Show was almost a cathartic purge, in a way. I could have done without the jewels and the dressing and the chicken outfit.
Yeah, you know? My dad, the chicken, I think, is a segment in your book.
I said, yeah, let's be fair. You would have made Freud a very wealthy man. Neuroses alone.
But don't you think he could have been on Freud's couch, but instead he was on my television and he really enhanced the world. So I think it was a better trade-off in the end. Okay, so setting the stage, the Carol Burnett Show was from, I don't know, like 67 to 78, almost, if not 25 Emmys. And it was in a time where variety shows, that was the thing. Okay, today's niche, today everyone's doing a superhero show, right? They're everywhere. Movies, whatever. It's all superheroes. Well, back then, back in that day, in that era, it was all variety shows. There was Dean Martin, Glenn Campbell, Donnie and Marie, The Jacksons, comedian Flip Wilson. Everybody had a variety show, and the variety show was almost like a modern vaudeville variety thing, where you would have comedy, you'd have skits, you'd have music. Everyone was doing it. However, the Carol Burnett Show outlasted them all, and there was just something different about that show. What was it? Do you agree with me? There was, I mean, I aside that you. That your dad was on it, but there was something different about that show.
CBS gave it a mid-season. Okay. They talked Carol and Joe Hamilton, her husband, at the time. You might get 13 weeks out of this, if that. They didn't think, CBS had no faith in it because no woman had hosted. Diane Shore did have a variety show, but it was a talk show, a variety show. But no woman had hosted a variety show. Dean Martin, everybody, they said it was a man's job to host a variety show. She said, nope, I'm going to do it. So she came into the first rehearsal with Lyle and Vicky and my father and said, let's just love each other. Let's just have fun. And the audience will pick up on that. If they see a boom, I don't care. The point was, it was real. It was Borschfeld. Whatever the format was, it was the sense that Vicky and Carol, my dad and Tim, they loved each other when they were together, or Lyle, and that she wanted that to come across the airway. They did two shows a night, so they would do an air show and a dress show. So whatever you saw on air was an edit of two shows. So, but her thing was, let's just have fun. Come to the sandbox. She had Bernadette Peters on. She had all these famous people on, but they came willing to put their ego to the side and just have fun in the sandbox. That was Carol's show. No ego, no artifice. Just come and have fun. My father was classically trained at Goodman Theater, Chicago. He studied with Uta Hagen and the Herbert Berghaus Studios. I jokingly said to my father, I said, you have so much classical training. You have an existential crisis just saying good morning. I mean, you do a half an hour just at the icebox. I mean, the light comes on and that's it. We can't talk to you for the rest of the day. But here's the thing about most people don't understand this. And you will understand this. You're a very versatile artist yourself. He didn't approach acting as a comedian. He approached acting as an actor doing comedy. You don't play the joke, you play the reality of the moment. So his role as a comedy was this. It had to have conflict. It had to have a resolution. It had to have a plot. But it always had to be based on believability. Whether you're doing farce or satire, you play the truth. You don't play the joke. You don't play the absurdity of the joke. You play the truth. And that's how he always approached sketch comedy or acting in movies and television. Play the truth. The absurdity and the humor will take care of itself. But if you indicate with your face, I'm doing stupid stuff here, it draws away from the writer's intent.
Isn't it about us learning to laugh at ourselves, finding humor in the day, becoming relatable? Something else that was very apparent in the Carol Burnett show and a lot of the skits with your father, Harvey Korman and Tim Conway, was the breaking of that fourth wall and theater. That fourth wall is you're watching like on television. You can't reach out and touch the audience. It's like you're a voyeur, just kind of watching a scene somewhere. But somehow they would break through that fourth wall and you were part of it. Sometimes it was because they were so genuine. You could see them trying to hold back the laughter because that's what they were doing. They were having fun. We were just invited to come along for the ride. There is one, I would say, in particular that might be one of the most famous scenes, and it's this one, the dentist scene.
Really hurts.
Dr. Kiefer will be with you in a minute.
Dr. Kiefer? What happened to Dr. Bermar?
Oh, he's out of town. He's breaking in a new partner, his son-in-law.
Doesn't hurt that much.
You won't find another dentist on a Sunday.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Enter this dentist.
Why, C's. C's? Yeah, see, in dental school and filling and pulling, I only got C's. That was just kind of an average grade. I got A's in cleaning, though. You want me to clean it for you? Well, it's... Well, let's just have an old look at that here. Excuse me, man. Let's see now.
Sorry.
Yep. Oh, on second thought, I don't think I will take a look at it.
Well, now what?
Well, my mother gave me these for graduation.
Well, so what?
Well, you're going to get them all icky.
T-O-T-O-T-H-E-R. Pull your tooth out. Boy, this is gonna hurt.
doctor, if it's going to hurt, please give me something to kill the pain.
Yeah, okay, well, got some Novocaine right here. Just, hold on that, Mel. Let's see how this works here. Okay, Novocaine. Here we are, Novocaine. Take a firm hold of the hypodermic needle. Right.
I don't know how many times I've seen that, but I laugh every single time. You just can't help but getting sucked into that.
Oh, it's the first sketch they ever did. Tim wrote that. It was based on a true story.
Which is funny in itself.
All right. The dentist took the needle, put it in the Novocaine of this guy's mouth, and the needle went to the guy's cheek.
Oh!
And he paralyzed himself. So that's where Tim got the idea. Now, I will say this to you only because revealing the truth is always important. My dad was a very disciplined performer. He did not like breaking the fourth wall. So I will say this for his fans. I will say this for people who love breaking the fourth wall. If there was any intrinsic value in him breaking the fourth wall, was that it did make him more accessible as a performer in public. If there's any redeeming quality in that he would agree with, because he was a disciplined performer, and he dreaded not being considered one, because he really believed in honoring the written word. He said, and I tell this people on my Harvey Korman page on Facebook, the only thing I'll say is it did make him more relatable in everyday life with his public. It made him more accessible as a human being. That it wasn't Harvey Korman, the Shakespearean actor from Jim and Vader, acting like he's above it all. It wasn't masterpiece theater, but it was the masterpiece theater of variety shows, because my father always viewed every vignette, if you use the word eloquently, or sketch he did, was everything was a little play. It had to have conflict, it had to have resolution, it had to have plot, it had to have character. Sure. It was believable, whether it was farce or satire. But you realize when he and Tim toured in the country together, they toured, my dad toured with Tim from the age of 70 to 80. He did 70 dates a year.
Wow.
You know, one thing people said to him is, we sense who you are by your laugh. Your laugh had a loving, warm feeling. And that's something my wife said. She said, I could always tell your dad was having a good time and he was laughing. But his laugh was so warm that you couldn't help but fall in love with him. And my wife said that. It's like, he had that quality. And I think, well, if he's like that, I wonder what his son is like.
Well, I will say you have a warm, loving heart, and that doesn't just come by accident. It there's a lot of nurture that's in it. And while your dad may have been classically trained and had been in his own right a very talented actor, having left this earth, his legacy is laughter and bringing joy. You can watch a very well done movie and you walk away and that was a well done movie, but laughter, I think, lingers on in you. I'm interested in what your favorite on screen moment may be.
To one that will for your listeners and humble me a little bit, there's a scene in Anxiety where this patient, Zachary Cartwright, comes into Mel's character's office, and my dad is one of the head henchman doctors with Florence Leachman. And it's a werewolf scene. And my dad puts his teeth in his mouth, and he ends up trying to scare this patient and making him think that he sees vampires and werewolves. And the whole scene is my father taking the teeth in and out and scaring this one person. But Mel can't see my dad's doing this. And it's such a well choreographed ballet between editing and performance. And Ron Clark has to see my dad when Mel's not looking at my dad. So it's just well for it. But my dad's putting these werewolf teeth in his mouth with these big eyes, and it goes back and forth. And because it's one of those scenes where, and I'm not grousing and I'm not putting anyone down, but I think my dad's best work, besides being Carol and Tim, was with Mel Brooks, outside Blazing Saddles and High Anxiety. But the day it was 76 or 77, My mom dropped my sister, Marie, and I off at 22nd Fox. And of all the scenes they could be doing, this had to be the one. If this one didn't put me into therapy for 30 years, I don't know what did. There's a bondage scene between Horace Lichman and my father. And my dad with ribs and chains in the closet with Horace Lichman. And that's the day my mom decides to drop us off at the studio. And I'm thinking, my mom doesn't need to see this. I definitely don't want to see this. But it was the entail of the scene. So my dad comes out of the closet and he's got his pajamas on. He's got these ropes and chains on his bottom of his leg and the prop guy's taking it off. And then we just finished the bondage scene. And my mother's like, thank God I missed that. I don't need to deal with that. And I'm thinking, I'm 10. I'm like, I definitely don't want to see my dad with chains. And I'm trying not to look. I don't really want to see my father, you know, like that. And my mother's like, all the days I have to take you to the set, I have to see my husband in chains. And I'm like, really? So my mom said, from now on, I'm sending you in the cab. I'm not doing this anymore. it was just that. But I have to say, there's a scene in there's a 90-minute teleplay called Eunice. It was considered the pilot for Mama's Family. My dad directed it in 1982, I think. And there's a scene where he is hitting on Carol Burnett as Eunice, and my dad's playing Ed. And this is 1955. And he says to Eunice, why don't you come over to my place? I have a new photograph needle. And I said to Dad, who in their right mind would try to make a photograph needle sound sexy? I said, that should tell you just how pathetic Ed was. But Ed thinks he can entice a woman to his room with a photograph needle. I said, how would you know to give that emphasis to that word? I said, what do you mean? It's like, I counted off. That laugh lasted 6.5 seconds. He said, you counted it? You don't have anything better to do with your time? I said, how about homework? I said, no. I studied everything you did. Your laughs always seem to last 6.5 seconds because you subtextualize everything you say has an underlying meaning behind it. So you make a face, wouldn't come over to my place with a new photograph, you know, and you hug Carol and you hold that laugh for 6.5 seconds. And then you knew when to talk again. So you didn't talk over a laugh. And I learned this by being on my father. The number one thing that kills a laugh is an actor on adrenaline, because the laughter is what inspires you, but the adrenaline of the laugh wants you or propels you to want to start talking. But if you talk over the laugh, you can't set up the next joke, the next setup. And comedy is rhythm. Anyway, so he used to tell him and other people who performed, why are you talking on a laugh? The difference between a laugh for a writer is the difference between him eating at McDonald's or eating at Spago's. you are the extension of the written word. You're the performer who's executing the written word. If you give something subtext that's not there and you give it subtext, you elevated the writer to a different level. So he always approached everything as, understand the underlying text of what you're saying to give it meaning. Because I don't know anybody in the right mind can make it sound like having a photograph needle is a sexy thing. How to do that. And I used that in the book. I said every laugh my father ever got, it seemed to last 6.5 seconds. And I told him that. And he said, I never thought of it like that.
And here you are following your father, calculating his laughter, his restraint, his timing. Who better to write a book? Because you're not only his son and the object of his legacy. And we see a lot of the good things that we saw on stage but didn't get to see in the offstage Harvey Korman in you. But you're also, you might even say you're his biggest fan.
I am. And I said this to many people, and said this, I'll say this to you. Even if he was not my father, he still would have been my favorite performer. How many people have to say that about their own father? Because my father never left the performance in his dressing room. A lot of performers can't say that. You never, so that way you don't have any regrets. You gave it your all. You can't say, I should have done this, I should have done this. Now, actors will tell you they are their own worst critic. Actors will not go see their own dailies in a movie. They will not go see that day's filming because they don't want to undermine their own process by saying, well, I should have done that, I should have done this, I should have done that. I've always said sometimes a daily or seeing what you did that day before might make it better. I don't know, but you never wanted to feel self-conscious because he was already a self-conscious person about his material. He never thought what he did was very good. He was always amazed when Burt Lancaster came up to him and me during breakfast in Hawaii and said, Hardy, can I sit down with you and have breakfast with you? And my dad couldn't believe Burt Lancaster knew who he was. His idol, Laurence Olivier, came to the Burnett Show and came backstage and said, Hardy, I love you. This is Laurence Olivier. This is my father's idol. Now, mind you, that they didn't know, CBS didn't warn, did not know Laurence Olivier was even in the audience, let alone the building that day. So he sat down in the audience, everybody couldn't believe Laurence Olivier was there. And they told my dad, I'm surprised my father didn't have a coronary before the show, because that was his idol. And for Laurence Olivier to say to my father, you're one of my favorites, just floored my father. Because my father always said, you know, Burt Lancaster and Laurence Olivier, they're the gods. I'm this little pisher Jew from Chicago on this variety show. Who would know who I am?
He's an integral part of a lot of America's, even growing up. In our final minutes together, I wanted to take it to back to our childhood. You had reminded me in one of our correspondence about one of our mutually favorite cartoon characters voiced by your dad on the Flintstones.
I don't get it. What's the big joke?
You ought to know, Barney. You're looking right at him.
Hiya, Mr. Gazoo. Hey, Barney, let Mr. Gazoo have a laugh, too. Tell him about the bus service to the moon. Maybe he'll want to make a reservation.
Flintstone, when you laugh, you show not only your tonsils, but your ignorance. Everything Barney said is true.
We'll just stop it there for a moment because I could just watch it like it's Saturday morning cartoons. I remember, for those of you who remember back in the day when cartoons weren't there every day at the touch of a button, Saturday morning was special and Harvey Korman was there as well.
Yes, it's funny. It's weird that people put Gazoo in such a high regard for the show because you have to remember he only did 13 episodes total. But he is the only actor in the history of show business who is technically affiliated with every Flintstone product. He's in the cereal commercial. He is in the video game, Flintstone Bowling. He plays Wilma's father in Viva Rock Vegas. He plays the Dick the Bird in the first movie. He did four voices in The Man Called Flintstone. But he's the only actor in the annals of the business to be connected to the Flintstone brand in the history of show business, which is odd to him because he'd walk down the street and I'd be with him and someone would yell out, hello, dum-dums, or hello, Headley, and he'd be astounded. That pulp culture-wise, it astounds him that he cross-references TV, movies, and animation. So when people referenced him as Gazoo, it blew his mind that people's children would come up and say, oh, you're Gazoo. So I said, you know, my title should have been for the book. You would write a book too if your father was Gazoo and a cross-dressing Jew from Chicago. But the publisher said that title's too long.
I think it would have worked. I think it would have worked.
Even if my father was not my father, he would have been my comedy hero, but he was my life hero. He really was, because he did, and my mom did too. My mom and my father both. The unconditional love that he gave me was the foundation for who I became. And my wife and my son just validate that idea that if you put yourself out there and you give your heart and soul genuinely to somebody else, you'll be reciprocated those same values. And I've been married to my wife for 19 years, and I married my best friend. And because she validates everything that, about me that is good. So I say this to people. For all the struggles I've had, the speech impediment, the language disability, not surviving birth, I now realize it, it's all been worth it because my wife validated it's worth getting your act together. It's worth believing in yourself enough to believe that you are worthy of love and to reciprocate that kind of love, because it doesn't come easily.
That's a powerful lesson that was infused to you from your family. And I wanted to share briefly what lessons I brought out of your book, OMG, It's Harvey Korman's Son. Again, it's a great read, and it's written in vignettes, and it's beautifully written, funny stories, moving stories. What I walked away with, though, is we live in a different era than when your father was on television, in movies, and on my Saturday morning cartoons. We've become kind of a vapid place. We've become anxious. We're selfish in many ways. Not to say there's not good in the world, Chris, but we're so divided and angry. And we're dealing with a whole new set of challenges. But, you know, just to get all Sunday school on us, the Bible says there's nothing new under the sun. And back in the day, your dad had to deal with the vapidness of Hollywood, the draw of fame, and yet his most important role, from what I read in your book, is the role of dad and investing in you. And the stories that you share remind us that life is worth laughing at, people are worth loving, and there is something good in the world.
All right, well, I'm glad my book shares that with everybody. I'm glad you interpret it that way, because I want it to be a feel-good book. I want it to be inspirational and funny, because that's what he brought me. And there are times, and beyond the fame, many of my bonding moments, Michelle, was with my father, just as we were playing miniature golf or sitting at a baseball game. Was that time with
it's him, those little guy, things.
It's a little thing. And I mean, he'd say, well, you might want to cruise, or do you want, I can send you, you want to go to camp, or you want, whatever you want to do. I said, no. I said, you send everybody else. And I have four sisters. I said, you can send them all on trips or whatever. Not getting model in the world, he's probably sentimental about this, Michelle, but I said, Dad, just playing miniature golfing with you, just spending time at a ball game with you is more valuable to me than what am I going to do on a cruise other than push people over the side by annoying them too much?
Do you see, men? Dads matter. Do you see that? Dads really, really, really matter. Chris, one final question, maybe from your book, maybe a story that didn't make your book that you thought of afterwards, but what is something, just a moment that you find just so amazing with your dad, just that one moment that you keep going back and thinking about in your memories of your dad?
Well, there's a video that was produced in 83 by the Disney Channel. It's called Through the Mind's Eye, and it explains how the brain works with people with disabilities. And he had a crew come over to his house, and I'm in golf fog, so I'm ready to go play tennis or go swimming, and I see crew members walking in his house with cameras and lights. I said, what the hell are you doing? I said, we're gonna do a video through the mind's eye. I said, why? I said, because I'm a parent of a child with a learning disability. It's like, in my life, not to be about a learning disability once in a day. It doesn't have to be about that. I said, well, Disney Channel asked me to do it. You know the Disney children. I grew up with Sharon Lund Disney, Walt's daughter. I grew up with the grandchildren. I said, well, that has something to do with this. I said, can I have it go without, can I go a day without having my life be about learning, my learning disability? I said, if I'm a public eye, I feel obligated to say, these are the issues that we need to talk about. I said, well, you can do it then. I said, no, you do it with me. I said, no, you can do it, because I went a slight overbite, not too much. Most of the surgeons took care of that. And I had a little bit of acne, and I was 15 or 16 years old, 15. And I really didn't want to say, hey, look at me, look how different I am. And My dad said, it's a part of being who you are. You're the poster child of what is good about having linked disability. I thought, oh God, I could be a poster child for this too. Isn't it enough that I'm just, you know, I would do the golf tournament? Just do it with me. It's the most widely used video to explain learning disabilities in this country. And I had more people say to me, at including the LDE conference, including all the years I did the golf tournament, people said to me, thank you, Chris, for doing that video through the mind's eye with your father. He celebrated disability as a blessing and not a blight. And that inspired us to celebrate our children as a person, not a poster child for a social cause, but celebrate the individual. And what a blessing it must have been to have a father like that who celebrated your disability like that and celebrated
absolutely
who you are. And so the hindsight was, oh God, I wouldn't go a day without having to worry about LD or being an issue. He said, it comes with being who you are. It becomes, it's a part of who you are, whether you like it or not. And I know, Chris, being my son at times is debilitating to your social development. But it comes with it. It's the pro and con being who you are and being my son.
Gosh, that's amazing.
But take the pluses, focus on the pluses and not the minuses of it. I said, okay, so I can say this honestly. The people I've got to know in my life would not have happened had my father not been who he was. So the blessings of my life in knowing you comes from the world that I have been exposed to. So for me to get browse and say, oh God, what, there are times, Michelle, it is a burden to be a son, but only because of what the expectation is, promoting the book and all the things I have to do that go with being who his son is. But the pluses are far more special than the minuses. And I have to remind myself of that. My wife reminds me of that. Yes, it's a blessing. Yes, it's a curse. But look what you get to do. Look what you've got to achieve in your life because of. So, and again, if I'd not been in the situation that I am now, I would not have gotten to meet you. So you're the blessing in my life. And I get to know. And so
my new friend Chris Corman. And what a beautiful story, reminding us that each one of us may have challenges, and whatever they are, your dad taught us all how to celebrate life, and he taught you how to celebrate being you, the good, the challenges, the entire package. So your dad's still teaching us lessons today. He's still making us laugh through your book and through those movies that we go and Google and pull up, and I'd encourage you to do that. I'd also encourage you to pick up OMG. There you go. It's on the screen. It's Harvey Corman's son, and it has been Harvey Corman's son who has been with us today. A delight to actually see you face to face, and to celebrate my new friend, Chris Corman. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Michelle, anytime.
And I encourage you, as you're watching, listening, or viewing, go to mymichellelive.com. You can click on OMG and pick up the book yourself. I think you'll really, really enjoy it, just like I did. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
My Michelle Live, entertainment review.
Now, if you've ever gotten plugged into the movies with Plugged In Movie Reviews, well, then you know Adam Holtz. He is the master of optical motion capture assessment for moral and spiritual applications. That's right.
Whoa.
Right?
Whoa.
Boom.
I mean, I fit that on my card, but I don't have a card, so it doesn't matter.
Stick it on your resume. Stick it on your resume, because, man, it plays. That baby plays. It is Adam Holtz.
I'm pretty cool. Plugging you into the movies, this is Adam Holtz.
Master of optical motion capture assessment for moral and spiritual application.
He's our
Plugged In Movie reviewer.
Take that, Andy Serkis, and your monkey suit. I mean, whatever. I got it.
I'm pretty excited about this week because there are a lot of things to talk about through 2020, here and there through 2021. It's not only been slim pickings, which I don't always mind. It gives us a chance to kind of revisit things that maybe we never saw before. But boy, when you get to see something brand new, it does get kind of exciting. So the big one that everyone's talking about is the first Muppet movie in quite some time.
Yes, we're talking about Muppets Haunted Mansion. I don't get to do that enough, so thank you for indulging me on that.
True story.
So we all know Gonzo is the Muppet with a big nose and big eyes and a big heart, but also a lot of insecurity. And one of his sort of stage personas is as the great Gonzo. And as the great Gonzo, he is full of bravado and he does things like jumping out of airplanes and trying to prove his, well, I guess it's Muppet masculinity, for lack of a better description. And so he hears about this challenge to spend a night in the world's most haunted mansion with 999 spooky specters. And he's like, boom, I'm in it. I'm on it. It's all good.
Would you like to see a little bit of the trailer?
Yes, I think that would be helpful.
I think that's well called for. Listen.
Yes.
Welcome to the home of fear and fright, where not all guests survive the night. The lucky souls will live to tell, and those who don't will rot in.
What's the matter with you? You can't say that. This is a family show.
What are you doing?
Welcome, foolish Muppets,
to tonight's very special Halloween challenge.
We just have to survive the night in this haunted mansion.
Everything here will seem familiar. But your eyes may deceive you.
Ooh, whoa.
I'm mysterious.
Well, we're just going to stop there because you get the idea. It's another Muppet movie. And you may have remembered the Haunted Mansion from your trips to Disneyland. There have been a couple of movies. I think Eddie Murphy starred in one in the 90s, if I want to say.
Ooh, I blocked that out, deleted that file completely. So
So another iteration. So I'm interested, does it live up to Muppet Mania? And well, when you're dealing with the supernatural, there can be some elements that parents might want to know about.
No, that's exactly right. And I think if you're a Muppet fan, you're going to enjoy this movie. And it's more silly than spooky. Obviously, the trailer sets it up with a little bit of faux horror movie suspense, but Gonzo and Pepe the Prawn, of course, wander into this spook-filled home and hijinks ensue. And it's basically, you know, Muppets with sheets over them, for lack of a better description. I don't think anybody's going to be like psychologically wounded by this, by scary Muppets. This is just, it's Muppet fun. If you enjoy the Muppets and have in the past, you're going to enjoy this. But I think you're right to point out, Michelle, that even with something really lighthearted like this, when we take a spiritual premise and sort of turn it into a joke, I don't think that means... We don't have to drop the 10,000-pound sledge on it, but I think it's worth talking about, right? Because Scripture has significant things to say about the spiritual world and spiritual reality. And when we minimize it by making it a joke, we may be internalizing a message there without realizing it that says this stuff either isn't real, it's make-believe, or it's funny, when we know that that's not the case. And so I think that you'll have people who are listening and watching today who think, it's not my cup of tea. I'm just going to go watch the Muppet movie again. Or even a Muppet Christmas Carol, for that matter.
The Muppet Christmas Carol has ghosts.
Right, no, we got ghosts there too, right? So,
and that's where parents have to make their own choices with
exactly
how are you going to handle things, because
right.
there's
a reality out there of people who, you know, delve into this, maybe take it seriously. Halloween is indeed around us, and it is sometimes hard for kids to be the ones that have to sit home when everyone else is having the fun. How do you be in the world but not of it? I guess that's something you have to figure out for yourself.
Yeah, and I think this one offers an opportunity for a teachable moment. I think that you could watch this movie and say, okay, what are the spiritual ideas here? How are they depicted? And what do we know from scripture to be real? And maybe your children are familiar with those passages. You know, Ephesians 5 and 6, Ephesians 6 has to deal with that especially. But maybe it's an opportunity to talk about spiritual issues that you've never talked about before, just to frame it in the context of, this is an important conversation, even if this particular piece of entertainment mostly uses it as a pretty innocent jumping off point for familiar characters doing funny things. So schedule some time to talk afterward if you decide to watch it as a family.
All right. Well, that's something to think about. As a parent, as we enter into this season, there are some movies that we bring up probably every year. One of my favorites is an older one, Something Wicked This Way Comes. I just find the moral content there fabulous. There are some very scary elements, though not over the top. And it is a film, I didn't research it today to give you the exact dates it was out, who stars in it. I just remember every year it's Something Wicked This Way Comes. That is one that we always turn to.
Well, I think as we try to help our kids navigate this territory as well, at the most basic level, I think that we can tell our kids, hey, if you're watching something and you feel uncomfortable, it's okay to pause it or turn it off.
There you go.
And to step back and just say, why am I uncomfortable with this? And now I may be in the minority here because I'm going to take a little bit of a swipe at something that I know a lot of people like, but I am not a fan of The Nightmare Before Christmas. There's something to me creepy about what Tim Burton does. So that would be a movie that for me personally.
About everything Tim Burton does. I'm not going to lie, right?
That's right. And so I get it. It's very imaginative. It takes familiar ideas and kind of reframes them somewhere between Halloween and Christmas, but it's not how I want to spend my time. And so I think it's also okay for families to say, I know everybody else is watching X, Y, or Z, but we're going to do something else. And that's a totally valid choice too.
There it is. You are parents for a reason. You were giving your kids for a reason. You're going to make the wrong decision. Probably lots. But you know what? All things work together for good to them that love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. You know, even those mistakes that you make, even when you try to do the right thing and it turns out, maybe I should have done it that way. God can use that in your kid's life. And when you do make those big mistakes, let your kids know, hey, you know what? Yeah. I was probably wrong on this. I'm just trying to do the best I can. Little twerp, you didn't come with an instruction manual, so I'm doing what I can here. Again, I did briefly look up Something Wicked This Way Comes. It was from 1983. You can find it free all over the internet, and it is really a good movie. I think it has a really good message to it. So a Muppet movie, maybe Something Wicked This Way Comes. I'm sure you can find a review at pluggedin.com because they pull out all the old ones as well. So that is a resource for you. Speaking of, I think you mentioned scripture, so I was going to make this little segue into a film whose maybe only spiritual content is the title card at the beginning with John 8:32, and the truth shall make you free. That it's called The Guilty.
Okay. Say more about it because I am...
The guilty is basically police that got demoted. He's not happy about it. He's stuck taking 911 calls. And he doles out his own sense of justice, where if someone doesn't seem to be deserving of getting 911 assistance, you know, a drug dealer or a drug deal gone bad, then maybe he's a little slower to give that kind of help. I think it's an interesting conversation in an age where we're deciding, well, should someone who goes to the hospital who's unvaccinated get that transplant they needed, or should we just punish them with a death sentence instead? Right. You know, it's one of those interesting dilemmas, and he ends up helping a woman who was kidnapped. He kind of goes at it on his own, playing cop again. So it's one of those films that Jake Gyllenhaal stars in it, and it is out as of was out as of October 1st.
Well, and I'm supposed to be the expert here, but I confess I've had some vacation time and I missed that one. So
what? You're not sitting there watching movies on your vacation?
Issue my mea culpa and say that you caught me just a tiny bit flat-footed on that one. But, you know, these things happen. So
Not a problem because, you know, you can imagine there's some violence. There's, you know, it's like a police show that's gone to a movie. You're not going to get any big surprises or any life-changing moments. It's a film, but it is a new film. So there you go. And if you want more, it is on the homepage of PluggedIn.com. I bet you know something about going to camp, though.
I do. There is a new movie out. And it's, I should qualify that. It's actually an old movie. It was out 2 years ago and it is called Camp Manna. And if you're saying to yourself, self, that sounds like a vaguely spiritual kind of camp, ding, 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 you get the star.
It is vaguely spiritual.
Exactly. So this is a movie that came out 2 years ago in theaters and is just this week out on DVD and streaming. It is a little bit of an odd kettle of fish on multiple levels. So it's done by two Christian guys who wanted to sort of do a lighthearted, satirical send-up of Christian summer camp. So that's our first layer. The second layer is it's a retro 1980s film. So imagine a slightly Christian version of Meatballs and you're in the neighborhood, right? And then the third element that I kind of love, and I kind of have to laugh a little bit, Gary Busey. I mean, whenever Gary Busey shows up, you know you're going to have some moments, right? Because Gary Busey is, well, he's pretty entertaining, sometimes
Gary
unintentionally. So this is just a pretty lighthearted movie about camp, and we have one camp counselor who is kind of holier than thou. We have another one who's very earnest, and we have a kid who lost both of his parents while being baptized. I mean, that's the kind of humor we're getting. And he's not a believer, and he doesn't really think much of God, but his new parents that now are guardians of him have sent him to summer camp. And he's just got questions about God. And so he sees some people that reinforce his sense that Christians are morons. And he sees some other people who seem to have pretty integrated faith lives that make him think, yeah, maybe this is worth considering. And movies like this tend to set you up for an altar call experience at the end where somebody comes to know Jesus.
But this doesn't. It just leaves you thinking.
It just leaves you thinking.
How about we look at the trailer real quick?
That sounds great.
Aren't you so excited, Ian?
It's a phenomenal place to get a leg up on friend making. Phenomenal!
I'm sure it is.
Who's prepared to make this the best week in the annals of manna history?
They forced me to come here, which is a huge mistake.
This is a man's camp, and you're a little boy.
Welcome, Ian. Welcome to God's land.
Oh, give it up, give it up,
this is
not a camp for fighting. This is a camp to learn how to be a better yourself.
Watch out for your testicles! Whoa!
How you guys doing? Found it. Found it.
Time for devotions. Who loves genealogies?
Let the God Games begin!
Let the God Games begin, and that's kind of one of the central features there. Interesting. This movie is maybe fun for preteens, teens, maybe families too. Of course, there's potty humor. You heard it in the trailer, so you know they let you know about what you're going to be experiencing. It pokes fun at some of the stereotypes of Christianity, which I think is just fine. We get pretty comfortable in this is the way Christianity is and this is the way it should be. And in that, we don't allow ourselves sometimes to poke fun at our own, not our faith. There's nothing to poke fun there. God is God and he rocks, right? But boy, his people can be a little bit weird and messed up at times. I'm not going to lie. But yet, you're watching this, aren't you?
Noted.
But yet in the midst of it, God can do something. Even with these broken, crazy, imperfect vessels, he can use them.
Well, and I think that this is an example, and it may not be the best example, but it's an example of satire. And I think that for satire to work, it has to be an inside job. It's really hard to satirize something that you haven't experienced personally. Like the movie Saved
with
Holly Culkin is an attempt to satirize evangelical culture, but it's doing it with such an edge that it just left me angry. Whereas this one, you might think, okay, sometimes these jokes and the stereotypes maybe go a little bit further than I would go. But it's done with a way that you know ultimately that a good satirist still has an affection and an understanding for the thing that he or she is trying to poke fun at, because they're poking fun to try to get us to look at it and ask questions about it. And I don't want to over philosophize this movie because it's not that kind of movie. It's not going to be up for any awards. And after our conversation today, I will probably never think of it again. However, it is trying to do something that I'm not sure we see a lot in Christian filmmaking, which is an attempt at satire. And so I'll give it props for kind of taking a swing at things from a different direction and gently kind of playing with some of those stereotypes that those of us who went to Christian summer camp are going to be like, yep, that feels a little bit familiar.
Well, I think that growing up, going to summer camp since, gosh, I was probably too young to go to summer camp just so that my mom could get me the heck out of the house. I may have seen each one of those counselors. I've had some not so great experiences, some humbling experiences, some embarrassing experiences, some this part of it sucks. But I am going to tell you that there is nothing better that I ever experienced in my life as a young child than going to camp and having that time away from the world where I could center in on God. I grew, I flourished, I had encounters with my Savior that I will never forget, and I have friends that I still love. Summer camp, you got to do it. Up here, Lakeside Bible Camp, that's a place to go. And then there's a lot of other great places too. Where did you go to camp?
You know, ours, I'm going to try to, why am I blanking on the name of it?
Because I asked you.
No, you did.
It's my fault. My bad. Oops.
Now, next question. I mean, camp.
Next question, please. Next question. Justin Bieber has a movie, Our World. What's that all about?
Yeah. Well, you know, if you are a multimedia star like Justin Bieber is.
And you and I.
Every so often, you want to just let people in on your life. And so we've seen two or three of these sort of, they're kind of documentaries. They're kind of part concert movie, part, you know, give somebody an inside glimpse. And this one, of course, is the first one he's done since he got married to Hailey Bieber, Hailey Baldwin originally. And so it has a different feel because it's trying to capture not just Justin's life, but his life with his wife. And so we get, you know, behind the scenes, what's it like with Justin and Hailey? And then we get concert footage, and then we get more behind the scenes stuff. So it's totally catnip for the fans, right?
Okay. Which I'm not necessarily a Justin Bieber fan. So I'm sure if you are, or if your kids are, that might be a movie you want to jump into. You can get the review at pluggedin.com. If there's any content you want to know about, worry about, there it is.
Well, and the nice thing about this one is, Justin has had some pretty significant things to say about marriage and about faith in the last couple of years. And so I think it's nice to get a portrait of somebody, not just as a superstar, but as a young husband and as somebody who's asking questions and thinking about things through a faith lens. You're not necessarily going to agree with everything he thinks and says, but I like this. I think on balance, there was some really nice stuff here.
I like that. Okay. That's always good when there's nice stuff out there. Oh, what's on the horizon, Adam?
Well, let me tell you, next week we have Dune. Are you a Dune fan? Have you read Dune?
I read Dune a long time ago. The movie was dry as toast. Unbuttered toast of the last movie hard to follow. But this one is like a who's who of coolness in the actor's world. And just from the trailer, I'm mesmerized. So I'm looking forward to this one.
So we'll have Dune next week. Teaser. I saw it last night.
What? Okay. I know. I know there's oftentimes, embargoes that you can't talk ahead of time. So I get it. And this is something you actually have to sign when we go and view a movie. Embargo on this, you know. And sometimes they're so militaristic too. If you've ever been to one, they'll take your cell phone sometimes. I've been to one where they patted you down for the love of chocolate, really. But we will be talking about Dune next week. I'm sure you can let me know though if it was
I loved it. I recently reread the book, and I'm not going to say much more than that. I will say, I think I can say this, and if I had done my homework, I would have known this. It only gets about between a third and a halfway through the book. So it is not the entire book, and there's going to be at least one, maybe two more movies. Assuming it does well, and it's going to have to do well because the special effects are amazing. The thing had to have cost $200 million. So
yeah, it's like the budget of a medium-sized country for this film.
Yeah.
So we'll be talking about
Dune. And we'll talk about Ron's Gone Wrong, which is a new animated movie that comes out next week as well. So those are our big things for next week.
All right. We will be hanging on till next week. Adam Holtz is more than just a movie reviewer. If you really were to be honest, we call him a master of optical motion capture assessment for moral and spiritual application. And on top of it, he's pretty cool.
Plugging you into the movies, this is Adam Holtz.
Thanks, Adam, and thank you for being part of it.
More entertainment at MyMichelleLive.com.